It is the morning show. We're learning about plans to move and build a new Milwaukee Public Museum. It would be a new chapter for the museum that was established in the late 1800s. What do you want to know about plans for the Haymarket District? What do you think of it sharing space with the Betty Brin Children's Museum? Conversation is right here, 800-642-1234. Again, conversation is at 800-642-1234. Ellen Senske is president and CEO of the Milwaukee Public Museum. Ellen, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, make the case for us. Why does your museum need an upgrade? Why does it need a new space?
Well, we are in a building that is a county-owned building, and unfortunately, the county just doesn't have the resources to put into that building. It has about $100 million in deferred maintenance on that, and that's just to bring the building up to the standards that it needs to be at, and not at all to upgrade exhibits and update them. And so we are our best. We've done a lot of studying of this over the years, and our best option is to build a new, more modern building.
So take us over to the Haymarket District near Pfizer Forum. What do you envision going up?
Well, a new energy-efficient building that reflects the mission of the museum inside. You know, we are a museum of natural and cultural history, and we want to make sure that what we bring to this new museum is really talking about that intersection of nature and culture, really about how not only how we influence and impact the natural world, but the stories about how the natural world actually influences and impacts us every single day. Look at a coronavirus. The coronavirus comes out of nature and slams us all, the entire world, and look at what we've done culturally to adapt to it. So it's telling those kinds of stories which are relevant in today's world.
Informing where we've been to figure out where we go next. How does the Betty Brin Children's Museum fit into this plan and this idea of sharing space?
Well, we have always been about not just looking internally at the museum, but looking externally at the community and how we can best serve the community. You know, we started out in our own building, but then moved in with the library in our early, early history. And then we've also, at one point in MPM's history, we were co-joined with and had the Discovery World was part of the museum. Betty Brin is approaching the end of its lease, and we're looking for a new locality, and in discussions with the community, they thought it was a wonderful idea to put both institutions under one roof. The synergies that it can bring are really inviting for the community.
Well, you mentioned community. How are you seeking input on this plan, and how is the community involved in how it moves forward?
So we have been getting input from the start of this, first in understanding what the community thinks of the museum, and then as we move forward through each step in our process, is to engage the community in providing feedback on what we're doing and helping us to shape where we're going. You know, we really want this new museum to be the voice of the community, where it is not just us telling the stories about all the different cultures and their relationship to nature, but having the community and those cultures tell their own stories of their relationships to nature.
So how could this new location increase accessibility for visitors? Would it be a better location to get more people in the door?
So, you know, it would be in the sense that it is directly off of an exit. So, but it will be, you know, our biggest goal was to make sure that whatever location we are in is a location that is accessible to the whole community, that the whole community feels that they are part of this. So, and that was one of the conditions in terms of looking for a new site, was making sure that we are in a location that is accessible.
Do you think in this age where it's pretty difficult going for arts organizations, museums partnering together, is that how you get through this?
I think it certainly has been how we've all gotten through it. You know, in when COVID-19 hit, we quickly formed groups that of cultural organizations whose leaders were constantly on weekly phone calls and weekly Zoom meetings, just navigating this together. And I think that that was such an empowering thing for all of us, was to know that we are not in this alone, and that we actually, when we share our ideas, we're not in competition. We're actually building up each other's organization. So
we're discussing plans with the new Milwaukee Public Museum in the coming years, CEO Ellen Senske, and we'll be back here in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the Milwaukee Public Museum's new building project here on The Morning Show. We're exploring the plans to move the most visited museum in Wisconsin. According to the museum, it sells about 500,000 tickets a year, and the building it's been in since the early 60s is in disrepair, as we've learned, deemed unsafe to house museum collections. How do you feel about plans to start from scratch? What do you want to know about the financial undertaking? How will it work to share space with the Betty Brin Children's Museum? Conversation right here. It's 800-642-1234. Conversation to join in, 800-642-1234. And the Milwaukee Public Museum CEO, Ellen Senske, stays with us. So, Ellen, you know, we're in the middle of a pandemic. Is it difficult to be able to put the financials in place and find the donations at this time of massive unemployment and economic uncertainty?
So, you know, we are very early in the stages of planning this new museum. And so we are in those planning stages. We have not yet begun our fundraising campaign, but we are getting ready because, you know, we all know that at some point we're going to come out of this pandemic, and the museum will be prepared to move on this project. So we aren't fundraising right now during the pandemic.
How much of the funding for this building will come from the county, will come from fundraising? Can you kind of break down where you'll get the dollars?
Well, it will be a public-private partnership. We have yet to put publicly out what that partnership will be, but it will likely be about 60% from the private donations and then 40% from the public side. Our collections are still owned by the county, so there is that commitment to continue to hold those in trust for the people of this county and for the state, for that matter, because our collections do come from every single county in this state. Our visitors come from every single county in this state. You know, we get school about 150,000 school kids who come on field trips from 45 of the 72 counties. So we truly are a state museum.
Well, Gary emailed us to say, will the new museum still have a butterfly exhibit or an IMAX? Will the museum have an auction for any display items that won't be reused? And Gary adds, I think the giant T-Rex would look great in my backyard. Ellen?
So we are still in those early stages of what will be in the new museum, but we certainly know those favorites like the butterflies and the and I'm not sure that IMAX, in that IMAX is no longer in the museum business, but if he's talking giant film and planetarium, certainly that is something that we are also planning.
So your ability to display and exhibit collections, is a smaller footprint, if I understand, for this new museum space. What would that be like?
So, you know, I think that everybody, I shouldn't say everybody because that's a generalization, but many people don't realize that our collections, we have about 4 million objects in our collections. The bulk of those are actually research collections. So we are a research institution where there is active research going on behind the scenes where we are generating new knowledge for the world, that natural history research. And that we want to make much more obvious. So many people think that everything we have is out on display, but it's not out on display. But we want to figure out how do we bring that, turn that museum inside out and make that research much more obvious.
So here we are amid COVID. How is your museum managing now? Is it open? How is it approaching this time?
We are open. We are open on Thursdays through Sundays, and we are just like all other organizations. We've adapted. We have time tickets into the museum so that we can control the number of people in the museum and also how many are in the museum at any one time. We have prescribed routes through the museum so that we can keep people from crossing paths, single entry in, single different exit out. We also require masks. So we are doing everything that we can to keep people safe during this time.
Well, Ellen, good to talk with you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Ellen Senske is president and CEO of the Milwaukee Public Museum. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. We're looking at how scientists are racing to develop a test for COVID-19 that is fast, that is inexpensive, that's easy, that's reliable. And a genomics researcher at Cornell is enlisting the help of his hometown, Racine, to develop an antigen test with saliva. Would you prefer a spit test to a nasal swab? Have you been tested for COVID? How long did it take for your results to come back? Conversation right here, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Chris Mason is an associate professor of genetics at Weill Cornell Medicine, where he's working on a COVID-19 test. He's brought his research back to his hometown at the request of his brother, the city's mayor. Chris, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, great. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, take us into the particulars of this saliva test and help us understand what you're trying to create here, because there's confusion around PCR tests and rapid antigen tests and antibody tests. What are you working on?
Yeah, there's a range of tests on the market, but they really break into two categories. And one is to see if you're currently carrying the virus or if you're immune to the virus, what's called virology versus serology tests. And so we wanted to look for the virus to see if people are actually really carrying it and are infectious. And I've developed a test in my lab at Cornell in New York that's a process called LAMP, which means it basically quickly amplifies a target, or a loop-mediated amplification. It's a long word that just means it makes many quick copies of the virus so you can detect it. And it works really fast. It's done within about 10 to 20 minutes. And it's actually something that we think really anyone could do. So we've been training actually firefighters and other people in Racine to run the test.
Okay, so when you run this test, this is a saliva test. Do you spit in a tube?
Yeah, it's really simple. You spit in a tube and try and collect about a milliliter. So kind of fill up the bottom of a little tiny tube. And then from that test, you can quickly heat it to inactivate the virus and break open the cells. And then we can run the test right away from the saliva.
What are you finding?
So we've been seeing, well, what's good is that the positivity rate is still relatively low in Racine. It was certainly not as bad as what we've seen out in New York City back in March and April. And so we've been, you know, seeing that it's relatively low, but also that the firefighters themselves really picked up the skills quickly. So it's kind of like taking little pipettes or little small, you know, eyedroppers, if you will, that just move the chemicals around. But, you know, we trained them within a day and also got them PPE and got them all suited up. And we had a little testing site set up downtown in Racine in a matter of a few days, working with Allison Kriegels at Medical College of Wisconsin as well.
So I understand you heat this saliva up. What happens in that heating process?
Yeah, so it is, everyone's saliva is as varied as the people from which it comes. So we see a wide range of colors and textures and densities. But once you heat it up, that actually helps to break things down and makes it so you have the human cells, which might be carrying the virus, get broken open. And also the virus itself gets deactivated when we heat it to 95 degrees Celsius, so very hot, almost like a hot spring. And then from there, you cool it down. And then if the virus is present, it has burst out of the cells, and then you can grab it and then basically amplify it with this reaction called LAMP that basically makes many, many copies of the virus if it's found.
How do you know that the tests are accurate? Because, you know, one of the problems here is missing infectious people, and then that could result in an outbreak and have huge consequences.
Yes, we just actually published a really large comparative study of all the FDA-approved tests that are out on the market. And our test that we've developed on clinical samples is about 99% specificity, meaning it's very rare that we'll actually get really a false positive, and 96% sensitivity. So it means that we're generally picking up most of the cases if they're present, maybe 3 or 4% you might miss. So, you know, no test is perfect. And we've seen this for every test on the market. But if you can really do more frequent testing, there's been a lot of literature that shows that it's more powerful to contain the pandemic. If you do frequent testing, even if you lose 1 or 5% of your sensitivity to pick it up, if you do it every day or twice a week, you'll catch the people who are carrying the virus, and that's more important than the sort of specific test itself.
So, Chris Mason, you mentioned the market. Is there a saliva test right now on the market?
Yes. What's good is there's now several tests on the market that are coming out. So there's our test, which is under review by the FDA, and a version from nasal swab is already approved by the FDA. But we are now actually other sites are doing something directly from saliva, including the NBA. So we've also been working with researchers at Yale who are doing something called Saliva Direct, which is just to make it even simpler, because you probably remember when the pandemic burst open, there were limited supplies for the chemicals that all the laboratories needed. So people in my lab, as well as others at Yale and
finding those agents, yeah. Those reactive agents was really difficult.
Yeah, people just ran out of reagents, like fundamental supplies. It'd be like trying to go to your kitchen and running out of flour. You know, really couldn't do as much. So it was really a hard time. But now we're working on protocols that, you know, go directly from saliva, so you don't even have to purify or extract anything. You really just need a heating bath and a few other simple reagents rather than more complicated ones. And so we're now partnering with those sites. They're doing all the NBA players. You've probably heard of the NBA bubble. That's how they're testing all the players down in Florida.
Chris Mason is an associate professor of genetics at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York, where he's working on a saliva test to test for COVID-19, the presence of it. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Chris, what is that FDA regulatory process like? And, you know, how did you get access to being able to do some testing here in Racine?
Oh, yeah. So we've been, you know, we worked with all the clinical staff here in New York to get some of the first tests up and running here. The process actually is very collaborative with the FDA. The FDA has been criticized a lot in the news for some early missteps, but they've really been very collaborative in getting tests to the market to make sure if something is a good test, they want to help you get all the paperwork in place and submission forms, quickly reviewed. So it's been really, I think, good with the FDA. And I was actually posting on, you know, Twitter and Facebook, and my brother, Mayor Corey Mason, had said, "Hey, I see your test. Look, it looks pretty good. What if we brought it here?" Because at the time, they were just doing temperature checks. And so I said, "Well, let's do it." So I actually packed up my car and drove across country in June to come bring and set up the testing site. And I said, "Okay, we need a lab. There's no giant biotech center in Racine, Wisconsin, at least not yet." So we actually set up next to the firehouse in the annex. And got tables and refrigerators and freezers and got all the.
Oh, you built your own lab from the ground up.
That's right. That's right. It kind of looked a little bit like Breaking Bad. It was a little, you know, of an odd vibe, but it got the job done. And we also, you know, got the lab set up and then all the equipment, trained the firefighters to help basically run their own lab. And so we wanted to use this as a model with my brother, with the mayor, to say, well, can we actually, so that, you know, anyone could set up a testing site, because not everyone has large labs in their city, but almost everyone has a police and fire department.
What have you learned about this process by going into a small community, your hometown, and setting up an experiment?
It's been great. Actually, we're going to, you know, turn this into a research study itself, because we had, you know, an IRB, which is called an institutional review board, or a full consent for the research of the city employees. So they get free testing, and we can, you know, turn it actually into a study of how many times do you detect the virus if you test people twice a week, or sometimes more frequently. So we've learned that people really, I think they want to get tested even once or twice for peace of mind, but then not many people want to get tested every week. But I think there is, if ever you've been exposed, there's a lot of peace of mind of feeling like, oh, someone coughed on me, or I just feel a little bit off. I want to get a quick test, and being able to do it in the same day right next to where you work at City Hall has been really helpful, I think, for the community.
Okay, so what is the status now? Where are you at with this project? Is that testing still available next to City Hall?
We're just about to ramp up for phase two. So we're still in the same lab space, and we've got a little bit of extra space and some other equipment coming. So we're going to be, we're now looking at how we partner with the schools and setting up other centers around the city. So we should be having an update to announce very soon of exactly how it will lay out across the city and for the fall. And we're doing some of the same conversations happening here in New York City. So when my daughter, who's 10, goes back to school physically, we're talking to the city council and other principal and thinking about, okay, how do we test my daughter's school and other schools in New York to help people feel safe and do it easily from saliva. It's much easier to do saliva than, of course, the deep nasal swab.
Yes, I mean, this sounds like a real grassroots effort to get into different communities and say, hey, trust us. We're going to take your saliva here, and we're going to give you an outcome. There's a lot of trust that's going on in these phases.
Yes, and you need to have methods that are well-validated, well-characterized, that have gone through FDA clearance. And like I said, this assay, or this basically test that we're using on LAMP, has been validated 2 times by the FDA already, and so we're just doing an additional version of it. But what's really exciting is it's not just us. There's now a large group across the country of people sharing these protocols and these methods, including in UW-Madison. There's a professor there, David O'Connor. We have these weekly calls to go over who's testing at different sites. He actually put all of these supplies and materials into a van for testing, a mobile testing facility. He calls the CoVan. So he goes around Madison, Wisconsin, and offers free testing to the UW students and anyone else in the community.
Okay, so what do you envision rolling out at schools, at the school level?
Yeah, so this should be something that is just like you think of your nurse's office at school, or if you feel a little bit sick, you feel off, you want to get tested, that should be available, which should be relatively minimal cost. But I think really when students first go back, testing like this and infrastructure, so you could test or even test everyone in the class, or test, if you had every kid spit into a tube in one classroom, you could just test that tube in what's called pool testing. And if that pool is positive, then you can go back and test every child individually. And so I think there are ways we could really have low cost but high throughput testing for the schools, and that's where we're building out those protocols as we speak.
What is the cost per test here?
So what's good is it's only about $5 per test, so it is cheaper than some of the other tests, like a $95 or $100 test, the PCR test in large labs. So it really is cheap, but it still has some cost. You know, it is not free, and so I think there's still ongoing discussions with, will there be another version of the CARES Act or federal or state support for additional testing. We've been very lucky. We had a lot of NIH and also philanthropic support for these efforts. So we've been able to drive a lot of this. But, you know, at some point, if it's a sustained effort in the community, keeping it going for more than a few months would require more support for it, of course.
Chris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Chris Mason is Associate Professor of Physiology and Biophysics at Weill Cornell Medicine. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.